This is now part two of Adam's episode. If you missed part one, go back and find it and you can listen to them both together. I hope you enjoy. I think it's awesome that that principal product manager role type is coming out. And I don't know how many good managers I've had. And I think if you do get a good manager, it's very quick and easy to be like, okay, this is gold. And then being able to work out what characteristics that they have that makes them a good manager and follow that. What's your view, going back to the mentoring thing, on, I've been thinking recently about mentoring versus sparring partner. I don't know if you know that concept, like finding someone who's actually on your level. What do you think about that distinction between having those kinds of relationships and your learning and your growth?
I think having someone to act as a sparring partner, and by the way, your mentor can do this as well, and your manager can engage in sparring with you if it's kind of agreed upon. And sometimes it can take a little bit more effort because there's a power dynamic at play. It's got to be a pretty high trust environment. But to be able to spar with someone on a level, I find super fun. I find it a lot easier than mentoring. And if anything, it's allowed me to kind of flex my brain a little bit more and be a bit more experimental. Whereas in a mentoring situation, I think naturally, again, I don't know if this is just a Kiwi thing, but you still want to impress and you still want to come across as a good student. Whereas sparring is, I think, a lot more freeing. You might be a lot more creative and that may get your brain working in different ways. So there's nothing wrong with coming up with your own concepts as well. Like a lot of the stuff I do day to day is a concept I've come up with that's been slightly modified from something I've learned or based on an experience I had in the past, but altered to fit the context. And I think sparring allows you to kind of think of different ways and try stuff out. And it's safer and it's slightly less risky to yourself. I guess I'm talking about, you know, that own fear we all have inside us of kind of looking silly or, you know, or looking like I don't know something or being extra vulnerable, which I think is probably easier with a peer, or there's less of that on the table when you're working with a peer than there might be with a highly experienced mentor. So yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it's a cool concept, friend. I hadn't really thought of that as an explicit tool to use, but it makes sense as far as when you're thinking about ideas and refining stuff, actually having a person to refine those with and help your thinking. Because I think it's the classic, whenever you're trying to solve a problem, if you do it in isolation, you often don't come up with the best path forward, right? And when you involve a group, always the results are better. So
yeah, I just want to pick up on that, Lockie. That was a seminal learning moment for me when I moved into leadership, is realizing that it's not my job to have all the answers. It's my job to ensure that I'm in an environment and creating an environment where we can get the best answers. And once I freed myself of that burden of trying to be the guy that knew it all and had the best ideas, I just enjoyed my job so much more. I can't even tell you. And my working relationships improved. My stress levels went down. My risk of burnout, I think, dropped off a cliff. Yeah, what you just said then is hugely, hugely poignant.
And you said that role, so the leadership role was hardcore. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because it sounds like at the same time as you realizing that you had the craft and you knew you were doing, you had the leadership skills. What about it was hardcore?
I think the transition going from individual contributor to managing other people, and for better or worse, I'd managed people prior to Xero, but it was always pretty informal and the culture was informal. So I never really got tested as a manager or a leader. I was tested as a workflow director. Whoopee. You can probably get AI to do that now for better results, but I'd never really been tested as someone that needed to make sure that the human beings that actually reported to me or were in my org were happy, productive, they felt like they were growing. That was all kind of either brushed to the side, never really taken seriously, or it was handled by a system process and it was just treated as a box-ticking exercise. So I think when I took on people leadership responsibilities at Xero for the first time, firstly, I was coming from a group where I had gone from being a peer of these people to their manager. That was a little bit awkward. That created some friction, particularly because they probably felt like they were an equal chance of getting this role as well. And for me to be promoted created maybe a sense of unfairness or, you know, well, why wasn't it me? And that's a hard place to start off from when you want to create like a high trust environment. And I also quickly realized that there was going to be more asked of me in this role than had previously been asked of me. So I sought out a lot of advice from people that were above me or my former manager who I really, really enjoyed working for. But it was really hard to put that into practice. It was just an uncomfortable learning curve. And I guess that's maybe a generic bit of advice is when you're taking large learning steps, it's going to feel uncomfortable. And the goal isn't to feel comfortable. It's to be comfortable being uncomfortable and to learn. And I wish I could go back and tell myself to not be so hard on myself for a start, but two, strap in, buddy. It's going to be pretty awkward and uncomfortable for a while you kind of build some of these skills and refine them, because whilst you might have had the title before and whilst you might have had direct reports before, you're being asked to use these in much more deeper, significant, more meaningful ways. And that is naturally just going to take some new skill building.
Yeah, and you mentioned the process of working through that uncomfortability. It's not a real word, but the uncomfortable stage there. I'm thinking you talked about being tested and measured around how you're actually doing that people management stuff. There was a pretty clear standard around what good would look like, et cetera, that allowed you to then grow into those skills, or?
I don't think there was a clear standard. I think that was one of the things that was hard for me, is that I was trying to measure myself to a standard that didn't exist. So all I had was worst case scenarios in my head and thinking, oh my God, these people hate me. They hate me because I got the job and they didn't. They hate me because I'm underperforming. That's further reinforcing that feel that they should have been in this role and I shouldn't. So it was probably a game of mental chess I was playing against myself more than anything.
Right.
But because I don't think I had great managerial support at that time, purely because I think my manager was exceptionally busy and we were navigating a large organizational change at the same time. So I couldn't really ask for more than I was getting. So I did feel a little bit on my own, I have to learn this, and I feel like I'm doing a horrible job. So I think if there'd been maybe some clearer standards or some deeper and more serious time allocation to mentoring me in my kind of leadership journey, that would have made the whole thing a lot easier.
Yeah. And as far as the growth journey goes, right, when you're first making that big leap into stuff, there's going to be a lot more things you need to learn. And almost at times that's overwhelming because there's so much to learn, and picking specific actionable things to work on is sometimes quite helpful. But I guess that's different when you're at the top end of it, when you nailed it all, and maybe it's just looking at small improvements or different areas, right?
Well, I think that's kind of sometimes where you get to as an IC. You get to the point where you feel like you've really mastered a lot of the core competencies. You feel like you're ready to take the next step. But when you do, it's still a really hard transition. You're now day-to-day doing things that you haven't done before, particularly if you're going from non-people management to people management, because it's a really different skill set. You might be able to share some of the things that you've found really useful in product or your particular discipline, but you don't intrinsically know how to lead people, how to be a good, respected leader, how to build respect, how to build trust, how to create a safe environment. Some of that's trial and error. And because, you know, it's cliche, but everyone's different, there's no template that you can look for that's going to be applicable to your whole team. Suddenly all these people are looking to you and they all operate differently. They all have different brains wired differently.
Can you share with us some failures that you've had moving into that? Because I think that's the thing where failure is uncomfortable and it's probably not something we share that much. So any stories there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple. One that stands out to me is when I first went into people leadership, full stop, I was more concerned with being liked and being a friend and being popular and not like those fuddy-duddy old managers you used to know. I'm the cool guy, right? And I put way too much emphasis on being liked than actually providing a good framework for this person to grow. It was just stupid. And whilst you're not there to be popular and you're not there to be liked, it doesn't mean you have to be a dick about it, obviously, but it's not the primary purpose of that role. That's not why that role exists at that organization. Maybe another failure, I think I kind of touched on this earlier, is I thought that I had to be the go-to guy. Like I thought I had to be the Steph Curry of the team, sinking three-pointers all day long when you really don't. You just have to make sure that people feel safe to take those three-point shots, congratulate them when they sink them, make sure they feel safe and empowered when they don't, and that's another chance to do that another day. It took me a long time to learn that lesson. I'm talking multiple years to really get comfortable with the fact that you don't have to be go-to guy. Looking back on it, that was a failure. And I probably could have shortcut that if I'd really sat and thought about it, but I didn't. I think because the nature of my work was really fast-paced at the time, listening to other people as well, that kind of goes hand in hand with that. Like one thing I've actively tried to do is not be the first to reply on a Slack thread, for example. I give other people the space and the time to express their own ideas. Particularly if you're coming from a senior role, you can cut off a whole bunch of creativity or thinking or exploration by jumping in a little bit too early with your reckons and your takes. And that goes for group meetings as well. One of the things I can't stand is when a very senior person is in the room at like a sprint review or, I don't know why there'd be in a product planning session, but I've seen it happen, a product planning session, and they jump in with all their reckons and all their takes, And just because of that power dynamic, naturally, people are quite afraid to then either challenge that status quo or bring something new to the table. So holding your tongue is a valuable thing to learn. And you might learn something as well. I have. I've had ideas that I thought this is the absolute right way to do this thing, but I've shut up about it. And then after a few other people have talked, I thought, oh, my idea sucks. I'm not going to open my mouth. My idea is terrible. There's so many reasons why this is a bad idea. And now I don't have the pleasure of looking stupid and then everyone else feeling like they can't challenge me and then going through an expensive build. Oh, turns out it did suck. Thanks, man. So I'm really glad that I've learned that skill. Well, I hope I have now. And then a specific example, I guess, I've managed teams where there've been juniors, there's been intermediaries, and there's been senior people. And thinking that senior people didn't need anything from me was a mistake I think I made. And just trying to act as a partner to them. And there's some truth in that, but I think I probably overplayed that hand. It's just, well, look, I might be your line manager on paper, but I know that you know all the stuff. And I kind of presumed the level of like, oh, they don't need me. They don't need much from me. And probably robbed them of a chance to at least express if they did. So I feel a little bit silly about that. And it was only really when this person left and they said, oh, I learned a lot from you. I would have loved to learn a lot more. I felt a bit like, oh, what an own goal. Like, because I could have provided some of this stuff to you if I had, maybe it was again, not wanting to cause friction or introduce confrontation. I was so maybe afraid of that and made so many assumptions about their own seniority and their journey that I didn't invest the appropriate amount of time. And it was a very operational relationship. Hey, this has come in, like, make sure you're across this. Yeah, yeah, sweet, check, check, check. And this person was a rock star. This person was really, really good at what they did. But I just wish I dived into, do you see opportunities for me to help you a little bit more and try to maybe open up a little bit more? Because I've learned a lot from people that I've managed. And so there's no reason for me to think that just because someone's also at a senior place in their career, they don't need anything. So yeah, those are probably some of my memorable failures. Should I hope I didn't give too many examples.
That's amazing.
Done nothing but fail.
They're also
failing upwards. Is that a thing?
It's interesting because they sound a lot like the kind of, I'm thinking here the culture, right? Like Kiwi culture. So there's a lot of what you've talked about is maybe what just happens in organizations, and you don't take a step back and think, actually, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah. What advice would you give to someone to question culture like that?
This is, again, maybe a little bit of a cliche, but something I've heard a bunch is assume good intent. So don't assume that the culture is a bunch of self-interested people that want to have a bad time. Putting that into practice, I think, can be hard, depending on your personality. I think I've rushed to judge and certain occasions where I thought, oh, this person's just self-important, or oh, this person just wants to hand wave about everything and make sure their name's in front of the right people all the time. And I think if I'd taken a little bit of a step back and understood why that might be, I could have maybe approached those things in more productive ways. So I think two improvements I've felt within myself is, one, not needing to jump into every situation in the clear and present. Afford yourself some time to collect your own thoughts and ruminate on it. And also write stuff down. I hate writing stuff down. Like, honestly, I never take notes in meetings. I never took notes at school or uni. I hate it. But writing stuff down in my career has really helped me formulate my own thoughts and go through a couple of challenge rounds before it's then presented to something else. So when I've wanted to tackle larger cultural issues, affording myself the time to really think things through and writing it out so I can express myself succinctly and articulate my point. If you do it on a call or you're talking to someone else, you don't have an edit button. You can't highlight a section, go back, delete, and reword it. And that's often like causes you to rethink as well. So I guess, yeah, take your time, write your stuff down. It'll give you that extra kind of bit of pause for thought and those extra couple of cycles of brain churning around to actually maybe get to a better outcome.
Yeah, great advice. For people that are looking to level up their product practice, would you have any advice or things that you'd land on?
I guess starting out in your career, two bits of advice I'd have is ask for what you want. Be that advice from people, time with your manager, tell them how you want to learn and how you'd like to learn. Don't be afraid to ask for what you want, because if you just sit there and hope for the best, it might not happen. And you've robbed yourself of an opportunity and you've robbed your organization of a better employee that you could have become by getting something that was important to you. And then the other thing I'd say is don't be afraid to take risks, which again, a bit of a cliche, but I think we're all afraid of getting stuff wrong, that we often don't take risks. And just put it in perspective. And I think if you've got two choices, one, it's risky, so I'm not going to do anything, or two, it's risky, so I'm going to do something, but it might be wrong. Always take that it's risky, but it might be wrong. Talk to other people about it. Make sure it's a two-way decision. But very seldom in your early career are you the one with catastrophic decision-making responsibility. So take risks, learn from them. I've sent stuff to production that's wrong, and I've learned from it, and we've fixed it. But it was better than the alternative, which was sitting in a room talking about it for a month and then finally doing something that was only partially right and then learning anyway. And I'm not talking about just recklessly shipping. I'm just talking about taking action and taking and acknowledging that there's some risk or some unknown with that action. Analysis paralysis is something that drives me nuts. And I think it takes practice to get comfortable with the risk involved with things, but you only get that practice by doing it and learning. You know what? That wasn't so bad. Yeah, it wasn't ideal, but it wasn't so bad.
I love that. That's great. I was talking to someone recently about risk-taking and talking about safe risk-taking as well. So I love the idea of taking risks, but also making sure you're setting yourself up so that if it does fail, it's a good fail. All people around you, you're doing it or whatever that looks like, but just thinking of it more rather than just being like, I'm taking a risk, bang, jump in. And then if it does go wrong, then that negative feedback might stop you taking risks in the future as well. So,
yeah, other people have got a responsibility as well to ensure that when you do take risks, it's safe and treated with respect as well, of course.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess that's maybe another bit of advice is we get bombarded with all this narrative around self-direction and take it on, guide your own learning and all that, but you do need the help and respect of others in your journey. You absolutely do. So sometimes I think, in my early career, I felt almost overwhelmed by the burden of, oh my gosh, everyone expects me to get better all by myself. It's really hard. And I think there's this false narrative around being a self-starter and, you know, self-made product genius and all this kind of stuff. It's bullshit. You do need help from other people. And don't be afraid to ask for that help.
Amen. We're going to switch to rapid fires. I could go on for a long time. So I'm going to start you off, Adam, with what book or article do you recommend?
I recently read something like the other day in an Uber about how Loom are driving people back to their product by using this thing called the curiosity gap. It was super interesting. I love learning about new concepts, and it's this idea of being deliberately vague enough to spike curiosity to drive people back to your product to find the answer, but trying to get that balance without being annoying and being like, I'm going to tell you some useless information. And that's how Loom kind of encouraged people back to their product and ensure that flywheel is humming. So that was really cool. The other book that I found really useful, not a big book guy, by the way, but the book I keep by my desk that I refer to sometimes is Measure What Matters by John Doerr, kind of like the Bible on OKRs. And look, by the way, there's no one framework or principle that I think this is the silver bullet. Do everything in this book and you will be fine. But it was just like, a lot of this just sounds like common sense to me. And it was really a good, easy read. So, yeah.
Cool. Thank you for those. Do you have a podcast or, I guess, audio book or something that you would recommend?
Oh, probably Product Journeys, hosted by Frank Gleisner. I bet I'm not the first person to make that joke on this podcast anyway. No, I had a baby 10 months ago, so I stopped doing anything in my free time.
Maybe like Netflix show is probably a better question then.
I used to listen to, is it Product School? And each week they had a different person from large tech giant companies talking about a different aspect of product management. I would listen to that while putting and unloading the dishwasher or cooking dinner or something. And it was just cool to like hear about things other people were doing. And like I said, it's all part of kind of building that mental tool set that you can then apply in context to someday. But yeah, Product School was pretty cool because it was really varied.
Yeah, I listened to that one. I like it. What are you most grateful for?
People taking a chance on me, honestly. Yeah, I'm really grateful for the fact that when I wasn't in technology, someone took a chance on me. And I'm really grateful for when I didn't have proper product experience, someone took a chance on me. It's really changed my life in massive ways to get into a role that I was excited about doing every day. And like I said, this is a high-paid industry. It's allowed me to live a life that helps support my family and has, you know, supported my growth outside of work as well. So without those two particular individuals saying, I think I see potential in this person and I'm not just going to hire in someone with 5+ years of experience, I wouldn't have otherwise gotten. So I'm really grateful for that. And when I hire, I try to ensure that you can't do this with every hire, obviously, but like you know, every so often, you know, we're looking at a junior or someone who's new to role. It's really important to me because it mattered so much to me.
I like that. Yeah. In a way, paying that forward. That's cool. Do you have a final call to action or something you'd like to share?
Gosh, very Jerry Springer. I think, and I'm going to give like a Springer-esque answer. This is probably a reference that only some of your listeners will get, but be kind to yourself and afford yourself the time to learn and the time to make mistakes, because we all make them. Maybe the single biggest change for me came when I started being intentionally vulnerable within my role. And I think that actually helped me progress in my roles much quicker than I otherwise would have.
Amazing. Yeah. I think I'm going to hit you up for a round two. so many things to learn.
I think I've got it all out in this pod. There's nothing more to learn from me.
That is it. Thank you so much, Adam. That was amazing.
That's good. Very sage advice.
Yes, lots of depth as well, I found. We stayed around the same theme a lot, but it was just reiterating, but kind of digging deeper each time, I found.
Yeah, and I think you could tell from especially those level up moments that he talked about when he had to put himself through into roles that he maybe wasn't quite ready for, that those were really big opportunities to learn and develop in his skills. And then obviously the importance of finding other people to help him with those learnings, and when he didn't have the support, going and finding people that could directly help him, that was cool.
Yeah, because he talked about plateauing or the hockey stick, and I wish we'd drilled into that a little bit more. What does it feel like to plateau, and then how do you know, how do you get that sense? I'm guessing it's something around feeling comfortable. So he talked about feeling uncomfortable, being challenged, and when he felt plateau, then he moved to a new company often rather than necessarily a new role. He's shifted around different company jobs.
And I guess that is a great way of accelerating your learning, right? Because it's a new context and a new way of operating for things. So yeah, it makes sense.
I wanted to ask him about, he said he'd gone to a startup and he'd really not liked it. And that's something that I was intrigued by, because obviously we just talked to Hannah Eichmeier and she was like, everybody go to a startup, like it's a must do. And maybe he'd agree that it's a must do and that he's glad he's done it, but bouncing out of that.
I think my take from it was just the time of life that he was in. He talked about being a really intense 3 years at Xero, and then instead of stepping to something that maybe was a bit more slow, it was another fast bait. And he's like, oh God, it's just too much. Which I guess that's another thing, right? Is finding those roles that you can achieve balance in as well, rather than it being all 100% all the time.
Yeah, or finding what you need, right? So if it was the money, environment, or role title, I guess that's craft in a way. So highlighting where you are in your career and what your next step needs to give you, I think that's a really valuable thing to do, to step back. I'm not sure how often people do that, but maybe he didn't do that at that transition.
Yeah, and I was also hearing when you stepped up into those people leadership roles, the idea of him being tested, and in a way it sounded like he was holding himself to this high standard, and this not being kind to yourself in a way makes those situations even harder, right? Because it's all this compounding weight of the world on you, which, if you don't have those opportunities for perspective to step back and be like, actually, things are okay, then maybe that does become difficult.
Yeah, or understanding, as you said, what good looks like. Is it what your expectation of what good looks like versus others? And maybe talking to a few people in that same role is quite helpful too, to kind of get that benchmark.
Yeah, totally. Or work out where they got lucky, you know?
Yeah, that's my takeaway. Get lucky. No, find luck. I don't know.
Yeah, just roll the dice, I guess.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review and share it with your friends and get in touch, because we always appreciate hearing from people.